This is our league, and this is your league. From the 55-yard line on CFL America Radio and the Sports History Network.
Stand by, 15 seconds to air. Stand by, all cameras and videotape.
Ready with your opening graphics. Stand by, Howard. Here we come, Frank. Ready, Don.
Stand by, audio, your opening music, and roll tape.
Take tape.
From 1948 to 83, Baltimore's Memorial Stadium represented the soul of a city. It was there that Colts fans worshipped a team that brought them the best of times and the worst of times. When the grand old lady of 33rd Street went down, 35 years of pro football history went down with her. Heart of a city ever beat stronger. Part of the proud legacy of the Baltimore Colts was their contribution to the growth of the National Football League.
National Football League championship on the line at Baltimore. Favorites are the hometown Colts, out to become the fourth team in league history to win two straight playoff titles. Vice President Mixon is among the jam-packed crowd with eyes on Johnny Unitas, the great Colt quarterback.
In 1959, the Colts beat the New York Giants 31-16 to win their second straight NFL championship. It was an accomplishment of major proportions, considering that a few years earlier, Baltimore barely had a pro football team.
It's very rare in life to have the opportunity to be a part of something like we were a part of. And, you know, when you get a chance to compete, at a level that there's not any higher level to compete at. For a city, you know, it's just enjoy it because these type of things don't come around very often.
In the 1940s, events that shaped the world ultimately shaped the future of professional football in Baltimore.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air. President Roosevelt has just announced.
World War II decimated most of the teams in the National Football League. But when the fighting was over, there was a glut of talented and experienced players returning to the home front. It was the ideal time to start a new pro football league.
I believe that America was ready to accept the new dimension that pro football was going to offer, and the All-America Conference provided that. America wanted to relax following World War II, and it was looking for some kind of a refreshing outlet, and what better than pro football on Sunday afternoon?
The All-American Football Conference offered quite the entertainment package, and when the Miami Seahawks failed in Florida, they were purchased, relocated to Baltimore, and renamed the Colts. But even the first cheerleaders in pro sports couldn't help the Colts win more than one game in 1947.
They went and said that if we don't get some player help, we don't see how we can continue to compete. So the All-American Conference's stronger teams got together and established a player pool where Baltimore would be helped. And Paul Brown gave them Y.A. Tittle. He had Otto Graham, and Tittle knew that he wasn't going to play, so he just handed him over to Baltimore.
Take you to Baltimore, Maryland, for the playoff for the Eastern Division Championship of the All-America Football Conference. Note the ease and the grace of Tittle's passing technique. Davis gathers in the pigskin to bring the Colts into scoring position.
Only a controversial play allowed the Bills to rally and win the game. Baltimore was leading when a Buffalo fumble was ruled an incomplete pass. Given possession and another chance, the Bills went on to score and won. The near riot that ensued was an encouraging sign of support for the team. That public passion helped the Colts become one of three All-America Conference teams to merge with the NFL. When training camp opened at Western Maryland College, the Colts had the look of a team prepared to make its mark on the NFL. And make a mark they did. Winning just once, the 1950 Colts ranked among the worst teams in NFL history. Even when things began to go right, they seldom ended that way. Embarrassment led to futility, and ownership backed out. The NFL bought off the team's assets for $50,000, including all of its players. The Colts became a ward of the league, and Memorial Stadium lay fallow for 2 years. Stockholders sued the league for stealing their team, then won the right for the league to replace the Colts with another team. Baltimore was awarded the Dallas Texans, a team that may have been worse than the one it replaced.
I played with the worst football team ever assembled, maybe the two worst, the 50 Colts and the 52 Dallas Texans. I was in, four winning games in 4 years, so we were building character, that's what we were doing. We played the Rams twice in 50, an exhibition game in San Antonio and a league game in Los Angeles. They scored 147 points against us in two games. How bad can you be? I mean, we were so bad. I mean, we really got the getting out of us. It's terrible, but it was fun.
But it could be rationalized. A bad team was better than no team at all.
The public felt like that the team had been a ward or an orphan left on the white steps of Baltimore, or the white stoops, as they like to say. And they took it in and adopted it. And surrounding it with so much affection and interest, it seemed like it was a challenge to the community to see if what kind of a success that they could have with the franchise.
One of the few success stories was a diminutive running back named Buddy Young. An acorn among oaks, Young mixed magic into the general despair of those losing seasons, especially when he took on a horse named Dixie, the Colts' mascot, in a match race. Buddy won the race, along with the hearts of Baltimore fans. Despite Young's talents, the Colts continued to struggle until they hired a new head coach, a frugal Quaker from Richmond, Indiana. That man was Weeb Eubank, the perfect coach for the times.
First, I tried to be honest with them, and I would tell them what I wanted, and as long as they were honest to me, we both got along fine. It was family. We had great team spirit, and that's harder to get now. Most of the players in those days didn't have some agent talking to them about who would spoil the whole party.
We had the genius to be able to give us an offensive system that was very sound, but also very simple. So we were not overburdened with a whole lot of plays, a lot of things to think about. We knew what we were doing.
Two holdovers from the Texans, Art Donovan and Gino Marchetti, were joined by a collection of mavericks and misfits whose rough and rugged image was embraced by a city starved for a winner. The 1955 draft was a bonanza. 12 rookies made the 33-man roster, including Alan Ameche, who scored a touchdown the first time he touched the ball. From Donovan to Marchetti, and from Bill Pellington to Big Daddy Lipscomb, the defense vaulted from one of the worst in the NFL to one of the best. Most of the pieces were in place, except one. What the team needed was a man with an infectious will to win. The Colts found their rock on a sandlot in Pennsylvania. His name was John Unitas. A hometown boy drafted by Pittsburgh, the Steelers thought so little of their ninth-round pick that they kept him on the bench the entire preseason. Unitas took a construction job and on weekends played football for the Bloomfield Rams for $6 a game. The team played on a junior high school field, coated with oil to keep the dust down. The skinny kid quarterback led Bloomfield to an undefeated season. And when the Colts heard about Unitas, they offered him a tryout. That 80-cent phone call would alter the course of football history. In Unitas, Weeb Eubank found the player who would define the game's most challenging position. When the 1957 season began, Unitas was a backup to quarterback George Shaw. But in the fourth game, Shaw broke a leg, and Unitas got his chance. His debut gave no hint of the brilliance to come. After his first pass was intercepted and returned for a touchdown, Unitas went on to play 17 seasons in Baltimore, a period when the Colts posted the NFL's highest winning percentage. The Colts added more key players, like Lenny Moore, number 24, whose trademark spats came to symbolize the syncopated rhythm of the Baltimore offense. Unitas threw at least one touchdown pass in 47 consecutive games, still an NFL record. In 1957, the Colts won 7 of 12 games and finished tied for third in the Western Conference.
That might have been our strongest team. What we didn't do in 57 is learn how to win. We could play well, but we lost 3 games, I think, in the last minute of the ball game, which took us out of the championship. So going into 58, we had a lot of confidence. We were looking forward to it, and we thought that we could do it.
The Colts began the season with 6 straight wins, including a battle from behind in Green Bay.
Starr passes again, but Andy Nelson, number 80, swipes the ball for the Colts and begins a brilliant 52-yard zigzag gallop that winds up in the end zone to give the Colts a rousing 24-17 comeback victory over the Green Bay Packers.
And I think that was a turning point because it proved to them that they could come from behind, which they had to do several times later on in the season, and that is the mark of a fine football team.
In late November, the Colts clinched the Western Conference title with an even more dramatic performance against the 49ers.
YA rolls out wide to the right and scores his second touchdown to put the Prospectors back on top 13-7. After the kickoff, Unitas tries to pass from deep in his own territory, but Matt Hazeltine picks off the deflected toss and fights his way into Prospector Pater. The 49ers have the handicappers all upset as they lead the Colts 27-7 at halftime.
Now you talk about a team that went to work. We were down 27-7 at halftime, and we needed to win that game to win the conference championship.
The Colts have a long road ahead as Lenny Moore takes Johnny Unitas' toss in the third quarter, and Lenny gets to the 49ers' three.
We shut them down the entire second half, and then we scored those touchdowns, four touchdowns, in the second half and beat them 35-27.
Lenny Moore sets out to change things in a hurry. He rounds left end and sets sail on a dazzling broken field run. Goal to Moore, Miss Agnes, 73 yards to put the Colts on top for the first time, 28-27.
That was the greatest football game that we played as an offensive and defensive unit.
Johnny Unitas throws to Raymond Berry in the end zone for the final touchdown as Baltimore wins its first Western Conference title with two games left. They prove their greatness with one of the finest comebacks of the year.
Here comes a fellow with the happiest expression this man has had in the football season of 1958. Here is the owner of the Baltimore Colts, Carol Rosenbloom. I hope that you'll forgive me for saying it, Carol, but I'm quite sure that every man on this football squad also felt that he owed that kind of a crack to Carol Rosenbloom.
Well, it's very sweet of you. I feel the same way about them, Chuck. Only one thing, you know, we told the fans it would take us 5 years to give them a championship.
Right.
It took us six. I'm sorry we lost that year.
You know, they'll overlook that oversight.
And thanks to you for everything.
Congratulations,
Chuck.
Carol.
But the big day, the day that none of us will ever forget, was Sunday, December the 28th.
Yankee Stadium jam-packed for the greatest playoff game in pro football history. New York Giants versus the Baltimore Colts for the national pro title.
And nearly 20,000 Baltimore Colt fans journeyed to New York City and Yankee Stadium to root on their beloved Baltimore Colts.
The largest television audience of its time, 50 million viewers, tuned into sold-out Yankee Stadium and watched the Colts seize a halftime lead.
Unitas fakes to Amici, then gets set to throw. George Preece and the other Colt linemen build a fence as Johnny fires a scoring strike to Raymond Berry, who was open in the end zone, and the Colts have a 14-3 lead at halftime.
Following a stirring and unforgettable halftime show, the momentum swung to the Giants. By the fourth quarter, New York had scored two touchdowns and taken the lead, 17-14.
The whole complexion of the game has changed as the Giants take the lead 17-14.
I remember what was on my mind when we took the field for our last drive. We were behind 17-14. And we could have very easily, you know, put the game out of reach, 30 points. And I thought to myself as we trotted on the field, we've blown this darn ball game. And then we went to work.
With only a minute left, Unitas throws the Raymond Berry.
A nation watched, spellbound, as the Colts slashed through the Giants' defense. Almost 50 years later, the image that endures is that of John Unitas, standing calmly in the eye of the storm, his legend swelling with each first down.
He hits him, and Raymond battles all the way to the 13 with just 7 seconds left to play.
With only 7 seconds left, Steve Clara boots a field goal to tie up the score, and that brings on the first extra period sudden death play in football history.
Here was a football game, two teams so good neither one could win. And now you go into an overtime period. And then the fans realized, you know, son of a gun, that's the way you do it. This is quite a game. If ever you needed one thing to close the deal, that game did it. It was just football up to then.
Later called the greatest game ever played, it was gripping theater and raised the curtain on pro football. The sport was in for a long run.
I can tell you one thing, it's a long way from the Bronx. That's all I thought. That from in front of Mr. Goldberg's candy store. And after the 58 championship game, I'm standing in front of the candy store, and Mr. Goldberg comes out and says, Artie, you big bum, are you out of work again? He didn't know I played football. So everything is relative.
My off-season occupation goes from working in a factory. I was a bartender. I worked at Sparrows Point as an iron worker. I set pins one year at my cousin's bowling alley.
The Colts quite literally owned the town, and their players were among the first to use their names to score points in business. The Colts of the late 50s were rich in star quality, yet they had a working class humility that matched the blue-collar fabric of Baltimore. The players lived in the same row house neighborhoods and drank at the same corner bars as the fans that cheered them each Sunday.
That's what made it nice. I think the closer you can get to the players and the action, the more fun it is for the fans. God, I can... remember Lenny Moore making one of the greatest catches I've ever seen on the far end of the field, and God, first thing you know, there must have been 100 fans around him picking him up.
Well, it was a blue-collar town, you know. Everybody liked to mingle with the football players, and we were the king of the hill. Many and many a time, Ordell Bracy and I talk about this, and we say, you know how lucky we were that we played in Baltimore? Because if we hadn't played in some other city, we'd all be gone. Except maybe Detroit, someplace like that. Here, we're still big fish in a small pond. And if anybody ever tells you they don't like to be recognized, they're either a damn liar or a fool, period. That's the way I look at it.
You just have to be in Baltimore to appreciate enthusiasm. I've never seen spirit that existed in any city as it does here in Baltimore.
Really pumped us up, really pumped me up. I ran out of there.
I felt I was in heaven. When I heard that Baltimore Colts song, I just said, well, boy, this is it. I'm the luckiest guy in the world.
I used to come on the field, and something would say, look around the stands and see all these people. At pregame warm-up, and I'd turn around, and I'd look around. I said, man, phew, I don't believe this. I said, I'm a Baltimore Colt. I'd be pulling at my jersey, looking at that blue. You don't know what that did for me. You don't know what that lifted.
In the 1959 championship game, the Colts faced the New York Giants again at Memorial Stadium. This time, there was no high drama or sudden death. The Colts won easily and secured their place as the marquee team of the decade. With that game, the decade came to a close. So too did an era in pro football. For the NFL, the 1950s served as a bridge from the sandlots to the Super Bowl, a time when the joy of the game reflected the glow of post-war America. In the next decade, the 1960s, the Colts would enjoy continued success with a new look and a new head coach. Injuries and inconsistency ended Baltimore's championship run in 1960, and the team fired Coach Weeb Eubank 2 years later. The Colts were uninspired, so management sought a disciplinarian as their next hire.
Weeb was just so nice that what eventually happened, some players start taking advantage of nice guys. And that's what happened with Baltimore. Some of the players start relaxing a little more than they should.
Our owner was Carol Rosenblum. And when Carol was going to make a change for the head coaching position, he asked his captain, Gino Marchetti, who should I get? And Marchetti said, there's only one guy. And he said, who's that? He said, Don Shula. He said, you mean that guy that used to play here, that defensive back?
Traded to Baltimore in a 15-player deal in 1953, Shula was a steady performer, yet hardly a star. But his dedication translated well in the coaching ranks. After a stint as Detroit's defensive coordinator, the Colts made the 33-year-old Shula the youngest head coach in NFL history.
I was going back to coach some players that I had played with when I was still playing with the Colts. I had to prove to them in a hurry that I knew what I was talking about and that I could lead them in the right direction. That was my toughest challenge as a head coach.
You know, it's like one of your high school classmates coming back and all of a sudden he's your boss at a job that you did better than he did.
Shula compensated for his inexperience with a hard-nosed style. Among his innovations were three-a-day practices, even in the heat of training camp.
438. Blowing calls. Listen to what the quarterback says in a huddle.
Jesus. Corky, what the hell are we doing? We'll get killed. Why did he beat you then? He got below you. Now, he can't get below you if you're looking the eyes into the belt buckle, right? All right, okay, all right. Nice, Sam. You had that face right in his mustache. Good job. All right, we're hitting some good licks, both ways.
Going hard. All right, turn it on then. When you get through, turn it on.
All right, we've had three ball carriers fall down just because they've got their legs hit. Stay on your feet. Let's go.
Shula not only knew his football, but he set out his rules and regulations, and you better follow them. And everybody knew that. We had a disciplined team.
If you had a meeting at 10:30 and you're not in your seat at 10 o'clock, $500 fine. So I raised all my kids under Shula time. And when my grandkids met him, they thought his name was Mr. Time.
Johnny Unitas, for one, didn't approve of Shula's methods, but would not say so publicly because the young coach became a perennial winner.
John really felt that he didn't have to have a coach telling him what he had to do. I think John felt that this is my job. It'll be my responsibility whether we win or we lose. And I think I know how to win.
John Unitas was a tremendous competitor, but he also, you know, he had his own ideas as to how things should be done. You really had to treat John with kid gloves.
One of them was a great, great football coach. The other one was a great, great quarterback. You know, you're not always going to be big buddies, but you can win together.
Though Unitas and Shula may have disagreed personally, it rarely showed on the field. In 1964, Shula's second year, the quarterback earned his second league MVP award. And with halfback Lenny Moore returning to All-Pro form after two injury-plagued seasons, Baltimore won the Western Division.
Some of the sports writers, and they're starting to say, well, maybe Lenny Moore has lost it. And that's all Lenny Moore had to hear.
And I said one thing about it. I said, I'm going to prove to those, you know, who think that I don't have it anymore.
So when he came back that year, he started off, and he started on fire. I mean, he scored 20 touchdowns that season.
It was just a reminder of the awesome scoring power of Lenny Moore. It certainly made things a lot easier on me.
Two NFL records were broken by Raymond Berry and Lenny Moore. Lenny scores his 19th and 20th touchdowns to lead the National Football League in scoring, breaking the old record held by Green Bay's Jimmy Taylor. He also extended his record-breaking scoring streak to 17 consecutive league games. Truly, this great Colt veteran deserved the honor of Comeback Player of the Year. Raymond Berry's 5 catches against the Redskins brings his lifetime total to 506, making Berry the number one pass receiver of all time in the National Football League. In defeating the Redskins, the Colts put the topper on an unbelievable season that saw them win 12 and lose 2 to become best in the West.
Shula won Coach of the Year honors that same season, leading the Colts to the NFL championship game against Blanton Collier's Browns.
We had, you know, the real, with Unitas and Barry and Lenny, we had the explosive offense. I felt that, yes, we were a better team, and I looked at the Browns, and they had that defense, you know, it bends, but it doesn't break.
In the first half, the wind was gusting off Lake Erie at 25 to 30 miles per hour, and both teams played conservatively. Baltimore gave Cleveland a scare by holding an offense that boasted Paul Warfield and Jim Brown scoreless for 30 minutes.
And we played a pretty tough first half. I think it was 0-0 the first half. And then the second half we come out and we missed so many assignments that we never had a chance.
We just were flat as can be. And I can still remember this day. It was 27-0. And there was like 20-some seconds left on the clock. Frank Ryan called a timeout to try to score another touchdown on us.
So I thought, God damn it, you know, if they ran a playoff, I was going to hit him if I had to chase him to the bench. And that year at the Pro Bowl, we did hit him. No, we did hit him.
Still, no single tackle could help the Colts recover from such a letdown. Shula's challenge for 1965 would be to keep his charges motivated. And he did so with some of the most creative game planning of his career.
In my career as a Colts announcer, I thought I'd seen just about everything. But believe me, Baltimore's 1965 season was a completely unique experience. After 10 weeks and with a 9-1 record, the Colts appeared headed toward that Western Conference championship. Then it happened. First John Unitas, then Gary Quazzo, both injured, sidelined, out for the season.
So now the only quarterback that I had to turn to was Tom Matte, who hadn't played quarterback in pro ball. He was a quarterback for Woodie Hayes, 3 yards in a cloud of dust offense at Ohio State. And that's when I made the decision to put our game plan on a wristband.
And I said, oh boy, and I'm playing against the Los Angeles Rams. This is when they had the fearsome foursome. You know, these guys bent over. I still couldn't see the linebackers.
Shula transformed his gunslinger offense into a ball control attack, and Matte responded, setting up the go-ahead field goal in the fourth quarter. Baltimore's defense then held the Rams in check in the final minutes, forcing a tie with Green Bay for first place in the West.
Bottom line of it is, I think it's Don Shula's finest hour as a coach, and our defense just, they put it up several notches, and so the game plan worked pretty well.
I think that's what coaching is all about. You have to take the material that you have and get the most out of them. And you know, that's the material that I had, and Matte was the guy that had to do the job for us.
The Colts used Christmas week to prepare Matte for the Packers in a conference playoff game and taped the same cheat sheet to his wrist.
Our whole objective going into the ball game was to somehow, some way, make a first down. And then if we made that first down, some way, somehow, make another first down so that the defense wouldn't have to be on the field the entire ball game.
But Baltimore's defense looked dominant from the start, scoring on Green Bay's first play from scrimmage off a fumble return and knocking Bart Starr out of the game.
And Matte stepped to the plate, man. And the rest is history.
Because they did everything knowing the position we was in. They did a lot of hollering, a lot of screaming. We're going to get you. We're going to kick you, you know, so and so and whatever, you know. Tom, we're coming after you. We're coming after you on this play.
Nitschke tried to rip it off my wrist. And I'm saying, oh, my God, what are you doing? He says, hey, you don't need that. You don't need help. You don't need to cheat on the football field. I said, hey, listen, I need all the help I can get.
He knew what his limitations were, but he also was the type of competitor that figured there's always a way to get it done, and he intended to do it.
Matte led the Colts to a second quarter field goal, but the Packers tied it in the fourth with 3 controversial points and 1 in overtime.
There's no question that the field goal wasn't good. I give that team a lot of credit because that probably, in my entire coaching career, that was the best effort from a team that wasn't supposed to be able to do it.
It was a great warm fuzzy feeling, but I was down real bad. And I got in a locker room, I took that wristband, I threw it in the garbage, and John Stedman picked that wristband up, wrote a long story about it, sent it to the Hall of Fame, and that's how I cheated my way in the Hall of Fame.
Baltimore failed to reach the playoffs in 1967, despite 11 wins and a third MVP award for Johnny U. Unitas threw 20 touchdown passes, including one in a loss to the Rams at season's end, which cost the Colts the Western Conference crown.
We lost, and they went to the playoffs, and we went home. But it was very disturbing knowing that you were still, the second-best team in the National Football League, and you didn't even qualify for the playoffs.
But Don Shula and assistants Chuck Knoll and Bill Arnsberger had installed a championship-caliber defense by the start of the 1968 season, with 6'7" Bubba Smith part of a ferocious 8-man blitz. The timing was perfect, as Baltimore had lost its biggest star in the preseason.
Well, Coach Shula, certainly not the most pleasant way to start a year, and I guess I have to start with kind of a negative question about John Unitas' arm. How is it, and what can you tell us about it?
Well, it doesn't look good right now because early in the first quarter in the game against the Cowboys, I think John tried to throw long to Jimmy Orr, and he felt something snap in there.
And Unitas comes off like this. So, usually he bangs his finger on my headgear or something, and I said, what do you got? And he said, I don't know, this thing feels like it's torn or something.
Unitas suffered a tear in his right elbow that doctors believed would take weeks to heal. Yet the Colts were in capable hands with backup Earl Morrow, who was acquired that summer in a trade with the Giants.
He himself had been a number one draft choice with the 49ers, played with the Steelers, the Lions, the Giants. He was well seasoned. That kind of attention was not going to affect Earl Morrow.
They didn't even know our formations, much less the plays. And Tom Maddie had to help him call formations for the first several weeks.
Morrow proved to be a quick study, winning the NFL MVP award after throwing for a league-high 26 touchdown passes.
We won 15 games with him out there. That was one of the great accomplishments by a team ever, and we did it without Unitas.
Morrow and the Colts' top-ranked defense mauled the Vikings in a muddy first-round playoff game at Memorial Stadium, scoring 14 unanswered points in the third quarter to set up a rematch with the Browns for the NFL championship.
The ball is free. Baltimore's got it. Racing for the goal line is Mike Curtis. He's to the 15, 10, 5. Curtis scores. Go to warm Miss Agnes. Baltimore's defense just took the ball away from Cap. And for the Baltimore fan, suddenly it is not such a gloomy Sunday afternoon.
Baltimore returned to Cleveland with old scars from the 1964 championship game and a fresh one. Its only loss during the regular season had come against the Browns.
So this was really sort of a retribution time for us, as we considered it. At least it, for me it was, because that was my hometown. I went back in front of my home people. My family was there.
Is it broke?
No, it's
not.
No, it's
a disappointment. I don't want to go, Preston!
The 22-yard line. Willie Nelson drops back to pass. He pumps one. Now he rolls in the pocket. He fires, intercepted by Mike Curtis, and he goes out of bounds. Curtis intercepted at the 32-yard line. Colts have intercepted, and they get the football back.
Tom Maddie then scored his second touchdown of the day for a 17-0 halftime lead. Wary of a letdown, Shula offered the Browns no reprieves in the second half, hammering them with a well-balanced offense.
Way to work, Tommy.
Damn, want to be in.
Way to go, Glenn. 66, option to Mackey. Hut!
to like 60 special individual to who? Jimmy. Jimmy's not in there. Jimmy's not in there. Willie, all right, Willie. I thought you said Jimmy.
Baltimore planned to throw to Willie Richardson on a fly pattern, and the play worked brilliantly. Off play action, Morrow went to the 6'1" receiver, and he outjumped his 6'3" defender at the 5-yard line, setting up Tom Matty's third touchdown run.
Ball turns, gives to Matty off the right side, touchdown, Baltimore! Matty zooms in over the right side for a score. His third TD of the afternoon. The Cleveland kid, Tom Matty, having a great afternoon.
The Colts defense administered only the second shutout in Cleveland history, holding NFL rushing leader Leroy Kelly to 28 yards and sacking former nemesis Frank Ryan in the fourth quarter.
Well, it was kind of a grudge game. Cleveland had always been tough on us, even during the regular season. So it was a great opportunity for us to go back there and get a little bit of the revenge there.
We were really on a roll, and we considered ourselves one of the best teams. I thought we were one of the best teams in the league.
And this ball game is history as the gun sound. And it's been a very gloomy, gloomy Sunday in Cleveland. But in that great city of Baltimore, ain't a beer cold.
Baltimore then took part in what was one of the most important games in NFL history, Super Bowl III. The Colts would lament not only the final score, of what could have been.
There, Johnny Unitas warming up. Had a muscle tear in his right elbow all year. He's coming along slowly. He may be in here before this one's over.
Shula had to make a tough decision. Here's a quarterback that had won 15 out of 16 games for him. Is he going to Unitas, who hadn't started a game for the Colts that year, or is he going to stay with Morrow? It was a difficult situation.
Trailing at the half, Shula went with Morrow for the first series of the third quarter. But after the Jets added a field goal, Unitas finally got his chance.
When John came in the game, I think that added a dimension. I think the Jets' faces changed. They might never admit it, but I think they looked over there and saw 19 and said, uh-oh.
Unitas piloted the Colts to their only score late in the fourth, but could not complete the rally. The loss hastened Shula's departure after the 1969 season.
Retrospect, if I had to second guess myself, I probably should have made the decision right at halftime to go with Unitas in the second half. That's one of the things I look back on now and then say, what if?
Baltimore ushered in two new eras in 1970, relocating in the realigned AFC East Division and hiring assistant Don McCafferty as head coach.
This afternoon, we're just going to start out with a regular practice and play catch-up football mentally for them. We're going to throw a lot at them, and these are men who have been through this before, and they shouldn't be too much problem for them.
Easy rider, we used to call him. Mac was, he was a quiet guy that when he raised his voice, it was for a reason.
The easygoing McCafferty enjoyed a good rapport with Johnny Unitas, and the pair opened up the offense that season, taking advantage of the emergence of speed receivers Eddie Hinton and Roy Jefferson. The Colts led the AFC in scoring with 321 points.
Unitas takes the snap, goes back to throw, looks downfield, set, fires long. Into the end zone, it's complete! Roy Jefferson!
Baltimore's defense remained a regimented unit, a layover from the Don Shula regime. The Colts shut down Super Bowl III MVP Joe Namath for a win over the Jets, and then shut out Shula's Dolphins en route to a division title. Baltimore then faced Oakland in the first ever AFC Championship game, and the Colts played to their strengths, made a few big plays, and let the defense gorge itself.
Unitas is set. Drops back to throw. He's got the time. He fires.
Memorial Stadium had enjoyed its share of victories thanks to the golden touch of Unitas and the ferocity of the Colts' veteran defense. But rarely had a win meant so much. It represented a second chance. With the AFC title in tow, the Colts returned to Miami, the venue of their most agonizing defeat, to face the Dallas Cowboys in Super Bowl V.
John goes back to throw again. Sets up, fires out left side.
Taken by Johnson!
On the next Colts possession, Unitas took a vicious blow to the ribs and was forced to leave the game. But Baltimore did not succumb to panic.
I remember John going out, and what we said to each other is we need to win this game for John. Our defense saved us in that game. I was just glad we had Mike Curtis and Ray May and Ted Hendricks and Freddie Miller out there.
Second down and many, many yards to go. Morton rolls out to the right. Gets the pass away down the sideline. Intercepted by Mike Curtis at the 25, the 20, down to the 23-yard line. The Colts have the football.
Get everyone a field goal, chance.
In a Super Bowl that was artistically lacking, it seemed fitting that it would be decided in the final 5 seconds by a field goal. Kicked by a rookie.
Come on.
Please, please.
9 seconds showing on the clock. The Cowboys and the Colts all tied up at 13-13. The kick is up and is long enough. It is! A 32-yard field goal by Jimmy O'Brien. It is good. He nailed that one. It went clear up into the stands.
One of your primary motivations is not a Super Bowl ring, and it's not a contract, and it's not another nice article in the newspaper. What it is that I can't let these guys down because I care too much. And that's why the same teams win and win and win. That's what the Baltimore Colts had when we played there.
In 1970, the Colts won a world championship on veteran know-how and a few fortunate hops. But the inescapable fact was that the franchise and the franchise quarterback was aging fast.
Your physical ability, how much of are you now what you were 10 years ago?
How much are you 10 years ago what you were?
Oh, I don't know, 70%.
You're pretty good.
You're less than that?
No, I'm 85.
Well,
I don't have as strong an arm as I once had. That's understandable.
Right.
It's a matter of knowledge and how to work, use it now.
The mind was still nimble, but age had robbed Unitas of his physical greatness. Yet, on a hot September Sunday in 1972, he provided one final glimpse at the legend. Joe Namath and Unitas would combine for nearly 900 yards passing that day.
We ran 100 offensive plays in 100-degree temperature. We had 14 play drives, 16 play drives. We lost so many offensive linemen that Bob Vogel was playing guard. He had never lined up at guard in his life. Everybody on the field was so tired. But somehow we went down and we scored just about every time. So we'd be on the field for 8 minutes or 7.5 minute drive, and Joe Willie would come out there, throw one ball, 80 yards, touchdown. We got to go back out there and play some more. And it went like that all day until he hit 3 or 4 more big ones and we didn't score and they pulled away from us.
In 1972, the Colts would go 5-9, but that was hardly the worst of it.
It was a traumatic year for Baltimore, and it was brought on by Joe Thomas, a man who new football players and new talent like few other men do, and he came in and felt like that a youth movement was necessary.
He made 17 trades the first offseason, compiled, I don't know, I think a record 24 draft choices at that time. He thought it was an aging, tiring team.
I can see that you needed some replacement parts, but I didn't think that you needed to have it done en masse the way that worked.
But what he underestimated is the love affair and the attachment that the people of Baltimore had for those heroes.
There was no fanfare, just cuts, trades, and benchings. And not even John Unitas was immune.
Yeah, maybe it could have been handled differently. I don't know how you handle that. When you reach a situation where you have a player who's past his prime, who is as good at his position as anybody that ever played the game, how do you handle that?
Did that bother you waking up in the morning and knowing that you weren't popular at that time?
Well, you know, it really didn't bother me that much personally because I knew what I was doing. People said, you know, you weren't diplomatic about it or whatever.
Were you diplomatic?
Well, yes, in my mind, how else do you tell somebody that they have to sit or what? And it was a decision I had to make, and I just made it, that's all.
Here's what happened. I mean, it was a day off, and so a few of us were in there to get treatment or whatever it is that we do. I was one of them, Unitas was one of them, and somebody picked up the phone and said, John, it's for you, and he walked back there and he said, okay. I was standing there watching him because my locker was next to that door. He said, okay, fine, put the phone down. He walks out, and Sully or somebody said, who was it? And he said, I'm down. I said, what do you mean you're down? He said, I'm benched, I'm through, I've been put on the bench. And the conversation wasn't 10 seconds. That's not the way you tell John Unitas he's not starting the next game.
The greatest quarterback in NFL history rode the bench for the rest of the year. Colts fans hope to see Unitas play one last time in a late season game against the Buffalo Bills.
It's the last home game. I think everyone in Baltimore realized that John wouldn't be a Colt the next year. Everybody in the stands is chanting, we want Unitas, we want Unitas. John Sandusky had said to John Unitas, okay, we've got the lead, I want you to go in and run the clock out. John would not have gone in the game, I don't think. Regardless of the fact that everyone was chanting, we want Unitas.
Marty Domrey soon joined the plot to put Unitas back on the field.
I had run in for a touchdown and got hit in the hip late in the game. So I came to the sideline, and John Sandusky, who was the interim head coach, came over and said, got me aside from John, probably 20 yards away, and said, John won't go in the game. And I looked at him, and I said, what do you mean? He said, I want to put him in the game, but he won't go in. I said, well, good luck. I don't know what to tell you. He said, well, you got hit in the hip. How about if I tell him you're injured? I said, well, that's fine. You can tell him I'm injured. I want no part of it, knowing John. And so he said, well, I'm going to go down. You stay here. So he walked down to John, had a conversation with him. I don't know what he told him other than he pointed to me and he pointed to his own hip. And John looked down at me. I shook my head yes. And with that, John stood up. We have the crowd's response. I mean, I'm getting chills just telling the story. It was unbelievable.
It was surreal. God, it was emotional.
Crowd's reaction was that they were probably going to be seeing Unitas for one last time, and whatever he was able to produce was going to make them pleased. Even if he'd have thrown an interception, they wouldn't have been too unhappy. Stands were up, everyone on their feet, and waiting to see what was going to happen. And John's last pass, maybe it was preordained, but in the middle of the crowd of Buffalo Bills defenders was Eddie Hinton. He came down with the ball and was able to break loose and go the rest of the distance for a touchdown. And right away, there was an airplane overhead dragging a sign that said, Unitas, we stand. And that was a final salute to John.
I submit that he waved to the fans, and it wasn't a long way, but I think he raised his hands and acknowledged the fans.
There was a powerful, almost a poetic kind of power to that moment that it's real hard to describe.
I wasn't there for Ted Williams' last at-bat, but I'm sure it was very similar to that moment in sports history when Williams hit a home run in his last at-bat. The most important aspect of the game that day was that John had a poetic ending to a legendary career in Baltimore.
In 1973, John Unitas was sold to the San Diego Chargers. Through trades, Joe Thomas had revamped the Colts into a group of talented young players, led by a laser-arm passer from LSU named Burt Jones.
Very brash, confident. Burt remind me so much of John Elway. I always said if you took the numbers off the back, you might not be able to tell the two apart.
Their posture, their arm, their size, their ability to run. They even had the same kind of toothy expression, you know, when they were playing.
With Jones at the helm, the Coltish Colts came together ahead of schedule.
We came close. We didn't win many football games, but the guys are real close, had a lot of camaraderie going on.
We all knew each other when we were all single. We all met their girlfriends, which later became wives. We saw the kids being born. We really did grow up together in community within our locker room, and the community in Baltimore was very much a part of the Baltimore Colts.
In 1975, Ted Marchabroda became the Colts' fifth head coach in 4 years.
As I scanned the prospects throughout the country, college or pro-wise, the name that came up most often was Ted Marchabroda from the Washington Redskins.
I've been an assistant for 14 years. And I think what I bring with me, number one, is experience. And I think number two is the fact that the last 9 years have been, they've been winning years.
It wasn't sort of anything that, well, we're going to win or that we're going to win right away. It sort of felt like it was going to be a rebuilding year for us.
You know, we were basically the same team that had gone 2-12 or 2-14 the previous season. Went into the 75 season not with a lot of expectations, certainly a lot of hope.
We went 1-4 our first 5 games, and we still didn't know how to win. We didn't know what it was all about. All of a sudden, for no reason, we turned it around. In the Buffalo game, we were losing going into the second half, and then all of a sudden, we just start scoring touchdowns. And from that point on, we start gaining a lot of confidence.
We knew last year, I think most of our guys felt that they may be the most improved team in the conference coming into this year. I know Coach Saban has said it a few times, and we knew they're always tough on us. Every time we play them here, we got to get out of here in a hurry, and this year is no exception, and they're definitely a tough football team.
The Baltimore Colts, rebounding from a 12-loss season, quickly became the hottest team in football.
It was kind of like a snowball going downhill. It just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Shake and bake is what we call putting our opponents in the oven and cooking. And we've had a thing going around for the last 4 or 5 weeks since we took fire, and we've been cooking people. And we're just having fun as a group, and we call ourselves the Shake and Bake Squad.
For Jones' takeaway. He rolls to his right naked and now looks, fires downfield. Caught by Chester at the 15. Chester to the 5. Chester scores.
The momentum. That city gelled around this team, and there was a momentum and there was fun that we had been embraced by the city. It really was the highlight of certainly my professional career.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Dave Humphrey, and this, for the Baltimore Colts, is the biggest game of the year. A classic confrontation between the streaking Colts and Don Shula's Miami Dolphins. This is the game that in all likelihood will decide the AFC Eastern Division Championship.
Miami had won 4 straight division titles, but the Colts had won 7 straight games and had captured the imagination of football fans everywhere.
It away, he wants to throw. Pressure is coming. Rolls right, sets and fires. Caught by Lydell Mitchell. He's got a first down inside the Miami 40. The takeaway by Burton. No fake. Deep drop. Wants to throw. Dumps it off to Mitchell. Mitchell's got a 35. 30. Down to the 25. Mitchell to the right side. Swinging back for the 5, for the 2, and he is in for the touchdown.
Oh, my score! 53 seconds to go. What a dramatic moment as the fog really now, Chuck, becoming difficult to see the field.
The late touchdown forced overtime. In the eerie Maryland twilight, the upstart Colts came shining through.
And now it all rests on the shoulders of a guy by the name of Tony Linhart. There it is, spot, kick, it's in the air. I'll wait for the official.
He did it!
Team are being mobbed by young football fans who have waited and waited and waited. And the Colts have beaten the Dolphins twice this year.
A win the next week clinched the AFC East crown. It had been 4 years between division titles, but it felt like forever.
We played in a mess, but we've sure enough passed the test.
We're the champs. What do you think, Buster?
The Eastern Division Championship is all in the past. But when we arrive in Pittsburgh, we'll be cooking with gas. There's no question there's a lot at stake, but our oven is set to shake and bake.
The shake and bake Colts were no match for the blast furnace that was the Pittsburgh Steelers. The steel curtain brought down the Colts' Super Bowl dreams in 1975 and 76. 1977 brought a new playoff opponent, the world champion Oakland Raiders. The Colts had now won 3 straight division titles and seemed destined to return to the Super Bowl. The game would be decided by 2 catches. One made and one in overtime that never happened.
And we dropped back and everything was perfect. Raymond Chester's route was perfect. My throw was perfect, except that it was a little early and it was about 2 feet further than where Raymond was.
You know, nobody guarded me but God in the air. And I remember the pass leaving Bird Jones' hand, and I looked at it, and it literally was, I don't know how far it was over my head, but it was like, wow. I remember that feeling of frustration.
I don't know that he would have scored on that play, but he would have put us in position that we would have been able to kick for the win. You know, there are a lot of things that will haunt you, and that one pass, I think I'll go to my grave saying, why didn't I wait? Why didn't I wait one more second and hit him?
In the game's 76th minute, the Oakland Raiders won the final playoff game ever played at Memorial Stadium.
And I think in Burt's mind, that play cost him a chance to play in the Super Bowl. And, you know, here's, again, one of the great quarterbacks in the history of this league that people have just forgotten that should be in that galaxy, and that was his one shot.
We were almost there. And after that year, it was a tough year for the Baltimore Colts. Matter of fact, it was essentially the dismantling of the last competitive Baltimore Colts team.
The wheels all seemed to come off at once. A Super Bowl contender imploded into a puddle of conflict, injury, and frustration. On March 28, 1984, the Baltimore Colts, without warning, were moved to Indianapolis. The proudest of football families had been put asunder. History has proven that relationships may end, but devotion is forever. Such is the bond between the football fans of Baltimore and the men who played there.
We were brothers. We lived each other's lives, and that's what made the Baltimore Colt tradition such a great institution here.
Memorial Stadium was given the send-off the Colts had never received. Old friends reunited, and for a time, the magic was back. The team may have moved, the stadium may be gone, but in the hearts of the fans, the Baltimore Colts will live forever.